first meeting since our annual retreat, and I thought that that was a very good meeting, a lot of really good materials and presentations. For this morning, it would be nice to go around the table, do introductions. We have a new member with us today, our representative from the City of Vancouver, Councilwoman Linda Glover. So welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
So I'll start. I'm Alicia Topper. I'm the Clark County Treasurer, and I represent District 3.
Good morning. I'm Doug Boff, council member from the center, and I'm representing District 102.
I'm Tom Breitenbach. I'm a low-income representative, District 3. I work at Lifeline.
Samantha Whitley with Clark County Community Services, filling in for Rebecca this morning.
I'm Janet from the county.
Jamie Spinelli, low-income rep for District 1. I'm an outreach worker at CMAR CSMW.
I'm Linda Glover. I'm the pro tem for the City Council representing District 1.
I'm Melanie Green. I'm community rep District 3, and I work for Every Home Schools.
My name is David Poland. I represent the deaf community and as an underrepresentative.
And we have a guest in the back.
Hi, my name is Mark Majora. I'm a director for a community development corporation called American Building Committee. Also here on behalf of Faith Partners for Housing and the Middle Class Alliance.
Welcome. Well, thank you everyone for being here bright and early. We'll run a tight agenda so we can get out on time. There is a 10 o'clock conference call for elected officials this morning. You probably saw the invite as well for the response to the coronavirus, and I think Cressa is putting that on, so hopefully we'll adjourn enough time so we can hear some of that important information coming out of Cressa. We have an action item to consider. We have in your packet a copy of the January 7th minutes, and I would entertain a motion for approval.
I move to approve the minutes of our previous meeting, January 7th meeting.
Second.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you. We have a motion and a second on the floor. Any corrections, additions, comments? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Hearing no opposed. Minutes are approved as presented. With that, I'll turn it over.
For the outcomes report, which I am seeing the first time as you are, so I'll be happy to review it with you. Did everybody get a copy? The Turquoise Community Action Advisory Program Summary Report?
Yes.
Okay, so the first page is the participant satisfaction. Program sent out 6,073 surveys to individuals who are served between July and December, and they received 766 responses. 88% of respondents indicated a positive experience with the program. And we have on the next page a summary of all of the community action programs that have been funded at the top for employment, health, social and behavioral health, income and asset building, and support services. These were all the programs that you folks selected through the RFP process. And then on the bottom half of the page is the homeless crisis response system programs that we're funding. Third page is the expenditures. Programs should be billing approximately 50% of their first year allocation through December 31st, 2019, because it started July 1st. And you can see how the chart that shows the spending of the different programs. It looks like the Clark College Financial Wellness Program hasn't billed yet because they have started late. And Shares Hunger Response is a little bit ahead of target spending because they did not receive other public funds that they expected. So there's the homeless crisis response spending below, and there's some notes on that. Lifeline's program is new, so they had a bit of a delayed start. They've been requesting referrals, and they should be going in the second quarter to make sure that they are able to spend their money. There's also a technical issue with the transfer from Community Services Northwest to CMAR. So their programs are operational and have billed, but they haven't been reimbursed because because we have the contracts under Community Services Northwest, and now that they're CMAR, can we pay CMAR for Community Services Northwest contracts? We're trying to figure out the legal thing around the organizational change. And And then Lincoln Place is spending more restrictive county funding before using less restrictive funding to make sure we get through all of our CHG funds.
And CHG again is?
Those are the homeless funds through the state. They used to be ESG, I think.
Consolidated.
There we go. Yeah.
Okay, fourth page, CAP system performance. The following charts show the progress of county-funded CAP programs making toward their contract goals. They should be at approximately 50% again, and the Clark College Financial Wellness Program is new and hasn't started yet, so that they're not showing the outcomes that they planned. But they have hired a program manager, and Rebecca's working closely with them to get them up and going. And then Volunteer Lawyers Program has served 97% of their contracted number, and they've been making huge strides to increase the type of legal services they provide. Looks like the Food Bank Fresh Alliance distributed 782,822 pounds of food in 6 months. It's amazing. Volunteer lawyers helped 110 households avoid eviction. 16 people improved their credit scores, and 308 people resolved legal issues. Shares Hunger Response provided 17,567 meals to 311 people at ShareHouse, and also provided youth with 1,310 food packs during the school week. And finally, Partners in Careers provided 59 workshops for Career Academy and helped 4 youth and 32 adults obtain a job.
It might be important to mention that this is equivalent to 3.5 whales.
I should have mentioned that. I'm sorry. That's a lot of
whales.
The homeless crisis response system performance. The charts are showing progress for county-funded homeless crisis response programs. They should be at 50% of their contract goal. And things to note. Lifeline is now accepting referrals from the Housing Solutions Center. They're working with staff to make sure they meet contract requirements. The Housing Solutions Center under the core system programs number served is based on need in the community. As the housing crisis continues, they're receiving more requests than anticipated. And several of Second Step's transitional housing program units are undergoing significant rehab, and so they've not filled vacant program openings until the repairs to those units are made. Okay.
So we have several new members on this board, and so I'm not sure if everyone is familiar with the program. So if you hear language that you're not familiar with, like Lifeline's ESG program, and you feel free to stop and ask for clarification. It's really important that we all learn as we go along. So when we start seeing applications in future years from these organizations, we have a really good sense of the work they're doing. So I just wanted to remind, like, even with acronyms, sometimes maybe saying them fully before we move into acronym mode for us county folks, that would be helpful.
Well, yes. I've been on board for 1 year, and my head's still spinning from all the acronyms. It's starting to make sense, but I've got a ways to go yet, so don't feel I'm daunted. So.
Thank you very much for that comment. Okay,
well, I've been doing this work for almost 19 years, and I sometimes don't know the acronyms myself. So. where was I? Am I on the
HCRS acronym?
Homeless Crisis Response System Performance page. It's anticipated that programs are, okay, all of these should be at 50% of their contract goal because they've been doing services for 6 months. And then at the bottom note is because RRH, Rapid Rehousing Programs, are designed to move households through the program quickly, it's not surprising that their outcomes are ahead of schedule. And then our final page, last page, is demographics. The following information is what is being reported for community action programs and homeless crisis response system in HMIS, which I do know is the Homeless Management Information System, and that's run by the Council for the Homeless. all the programs that we fund are required to input their information in that system so that we can get an accurate idea of who's being served. Looks like 4,473 responses on race, and majority of people served are white. 465 are black or African American. 155 are American Indian, Alaskan Native. 181 Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander, and 56 Asian people. The gender responses look roughly 50-50 male and female, and 30 who are gender non-conforming were served. The age, you can see the pie chart there. I guess I won't cover all those numbers, but the majority of people are between the ages of 24 and 44. Educational level looks like a pretty even split as well, with the majority of people being served high school graduates or GEDs, 1,335 people. And then we also track other characteristics, such as the number who were served that were chronically homeless. There were 879. There were 276 veterans who were served, and 1,959 people who have a disability.
A question on that. Is
sure.
Is there any duplication? Could respondents answer more than once? If they could say, if, for example, other characteristics, we've got three on here. Could one person fall into two of the three, and would it be reported that way, or could they only report one characteristic?
I would assume that they that there are people who are veterans and who are disabled and could report on each category that they fit in. But maybe Tom
right.
is even more familiar. Okay.
Yes, you can, like chronically homeless. Veterans and disability are all separate characteristics you can report on. And same thing with education, gender, race.
Okay, so. Thank you.
Is there any other questions?
Do we have any idea why the target provision for households increasing income on the page just before that?
I'm sorry.
As low as it is, the target
on the increased income?
Mm-hmm.
Why is targeted prevention low?
Yeah, so you explained why rapid rehousing is high, which makes perfect sense, but it says that they should be at 50% and they're significantly lower.
I'll write that question down and I'll ask Rebecca.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, very good report. We had a few people join us. For those that just came in, we did have an opportunity to go around the table and do introductions. If you want to just do a quick introduction, to start with Amy. On the legislative committee and would be able to provide an update in Adam's absence. Maybe it's a committee of one.
Okay.
I know that I've been going to two different meetings, so I don't know what the official name is, but I went to a meeting, we were discussing what we want to support, but we had not like focused that we were exactly going to have a certain thing that we were going to propose or anything at this time.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was.
Very good. Well, we'll postpone until Adam returns. I do know that I've seen emails and action alerts
mm-hmm.
come from the department asking for our support of various legislation. So if you do see those and you find that you would like to lend your voice for support, you have the ability to do so under the banner of CAB as a member of this board. So I did have an opportunity to go to Olympia and testify twice this session, and I was able to mention my affiliation with this group, and I think it does make a difference for our legislators to know that you're representing the community and also this board. So feel free to go up and legislate, do so locally as well, and Adam report when he gets back. And with that, community needs assessment, I know Rebecca's not here, but are there any updates other than what we got in our report this morning?
Yeah, she said that they received 1,655 surveys, which is 500 more than what we received 3 years ago when we sent out surveys. And she is going to email the board a full update on the community needs assessment.
Fantastic.
Good. And same for the next topic. Michael will send out an email to everybody with any legislative updates.
Good. I know that we looked at two different agendas. One was Low Income Housing Alliance and their legislative agenda. And then the second was a national organization that I...
Poverty in Action.
Yeah, Poverty in Action, which I hadn't been tracking before, so that was good to see. So we have a City of Vancouver Affordable Housing Fund update with Peggy Sheehan. Usually is here. She was not here this morning.
Nope.
Did she RSVP to
no,
be here?
No.
Okay.
I do. I heard that there's an application out for subsidy funds that went out yesterday. It was posted yesterday for the affordable housing. But I did. But I don't know whether or not there was other funds available for other projects or not. So we'd have to check.
I don't want to put Linda on the spot, but okay. So usually Peggy provides a report on the affordable housing fund. And I know that the allocation of dollars changes each year based on the City Council's direction. Do you know if you guys have set the Affordable Housing Fund allocations yet?
No, I'm not for sure.
Okay, we can wait for Peggy as well. Yeah, I haven't seen, I don't know either. Well, with that, we'll skip that item as well. And give Peggy a hard time for not being here.
I sent her a text, so... Maybe.
Did she know she was on the agenda for 9?
I should have taken a lot more time on that report. Do you guys want to re-review it?
It's really bad. I'm wondering if she thinks she's supposed to be here at 9.
You know, yeah. We should go over all that.
In detail.
I want to know more about that as well.
We could require everyone to ask at least one question.
I could expand on the community needs assessment task force.
Yeah, let's do it, please.
So we're looking at different areas to provide different forums to bring the community together to review the data that was collected and share that out, and also have some interactive table discussions. And so I know, Rebecca, last meeting we brainstormed locations and just space that would potentially accommodate larger groups, and so I know Rebecca was going to reach out to a couple different venues to see about what was available. And so we're looking at somewhere towards Washougal. We're looking at the library for the full day, so that gives an opportunity for anyone just passing through the library to meander through, look at the data. We talk about having some interactive questions up on the screen that what we would do with a table talk, since they won't be there necessarily for the table talk, but have some of that interactive engagement. We thought also about capturing some of the data about who's coming through, because that's something we do with the evening forums. Everyone gets some little device where, you know, the information they plug in will be shown to everyone to collect, you know, perceptions or you know, certain like different, like who you're from or where you're from and stuff like that. So we talked about having maybe some laptops available so people could fill in that information as they walk through the library during the day, so we can kind of see who came through, and then have an opportunity to invite them back for the evening for the larger discussion. We also kind of debated between Ridgefield, Battleground, Amboy, the North area, just trying to hit all the different areas so that people would feel like it's part of their community and wouldn't have to travel necessarily very far, but also recognizing people come from work. So hopefully they'll hit whatever is most convenient for them. So that's kind of the planning stage. We talked about the questions we wanted to have for the table talk, looking at them through an equity lens. And so just really kind of just pulling out what those events could look like and how to make it more you know, most beneficial, meaningful for the people who attend, and also the information we gather.
So is the goal too, is it the goal as part of our needs assessment, just to kind of attract a broader audience, or at least
mm-hmm.
in, adi- addition to our needs assessment outside?
Yeah, so this is just to share the information back to the community. So we see a lot of, like, the downtown Vancouver probably getting a lot of people in the social services sector come through, maybe some elected officials, community members. So it's really just share that information back to the community about what the needs were based on the survey information. And so I think the survey, they had a drop-dead date where everything had to be entered because they were still getting some through the mail. I think it was a couple weeks ago where they had to just shut it down, but I think they did get a lot in the mail. So all that was going to be entered. Then it was going to go through the consulting firm to make sure nothing was biased. And so then we'd have that feedback from that so that we could provide that information out at the different forums. So be on the lookout for future forum dates, and I'm sure they'll be announced across the community, but encourage colleagues or neighbors, friends to attend. I think the more people that come and attend, just the more meaningful discussion we can have.
I have a question. Those kinds of meetings and the information that's collected from those meetings, do they impact any changes, potential changes to the direction the county takes? Because I know that they're prioritized by what the community assessment says are the most important things.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a large difference between what those table talks or those conversations come about with the community assessment portrays, is there potential of that changing, or is it more just to get the word out so that people know the direction the county will be looking?
My understanding is it's more just to have that feedback, but the survey stands, that's my understanding.
So when we're all done, they're going to make us the needs assessment. Is like a packet that we've seen before. And it was my understanding that helps direct what we do is in the funding, the direction that we take our funding and the choices that we make here at the table. So that was my understanding of it. So, and an informed community. So.
And I think there's a requirement for the quantitative data as well as some qualitative data. And so the forums are collecting that qualitative data. But I think we lean a little bit more heavily on the surveys that are from people who are living in poverty themselves.
Great. Thank you.
We also talked about having some of the qualitative data. So a lot of people did put their contact information on the survey when they completed it. And so those individuals will be connected with and give an opportunity to come together for more of a specific discussion around the needs that they identified in the survey. Is that correct? Or they're going to have like a focus group, I think, is more, not so much a forum, but more of a focus group for individuals who want to be involved. I think that's cool. Okay.
Sounds good. Thank you, Melanie. We have a presentation that's scheduled for 9:15, which is Impact Northwest Rapid Rehousing and Permanent Supportive Housing Program. And I think, were we having a guest here today to provide that presentation?
Yes, RJ from Impact will be here.
Okay.
So, again, we're early.
Yeah.
if you're interested, I could tell you about my discussion about our last meeting with the deaf community and what we're planning to do.
Yeah, and normally you wouldn't want to hold up an agenda for presenters, I think that's fair since we've already invited them, so this would be a good opportunity for us as members maybe to do a round table and just update on work that we've been doing in this area. So that's a great idea. So, yeah, kick us off, David.
Okay. So I made a lot of notes from that meeting, and I took some pictures of some of the PowerPoint slides, which were really interesting. I learned a lot from it, and everybody takes away different things. What I took away from it was they say we're not interested in changing the federal definition of homeless to include what hearing people say for hearing homeless as couch surfers. Mm-hmm. Because they see people that sleep on the streets or in the car as the most vulnerable. That was the key two words, most vulnerable. In the deaf community, We purposely do not allow people, if they don't have a reputation of abuse, like being a rapist, a killer, or something like that, we purposely do not allow them to be on the street. So we have this weird conundrum where the reason we don't let them be on the street is because they are the most vulnerable. They are that. That's why they're not on the street. So it's kind of like this conflict, because when we don't call it couch surfing for our people, we call it house hopping. And so it may look similar, but it's for a different reason. It's not that, hey, I got a best buddy, or my mom has a basement, I'm just going to go couch surfing. It's more like, okay, I know you, I know this girl, she has a job at WSD, she has a disability, she's willing to pay all your rent for you. If you want to pay anything, can she please stay with you? Because she can't get a place by herself, and she has a dog, it's a special needs dog. Can she stay with you? Because I know you, I can trust you. It's like that. And so I've had people ask me if people could stay with me. And so I had a discussion with the CEO of Tillicum, who they now serve about 26 counties. They are situated here in Vancouver, and I asked if I could do a PowerPoint presentation on some of the things that were applicable with what I learned from being in this group and from that meeting, to what can we do to try to help the deaf who are homeless throughout the state. They take care of Spokane, the Tri-Cities, Yakima, Vancouver, a lot of different places. So we're going to have a meeting on Wednesday the 18th at 4 to 5 at Tillicum, and some of the people are going to be on VP on the screen and participating that way, and we'll do a question and answer thing where I'm sure I'll learn stuff that I might be able to share with you guys if you're interested. But she shared one thing interesting with me. She said they're willing to learn from you what you've discovered, but they want to share with you what they know at this moment. And their understanding is that all shelters in Washington State are required to reserve at least 5 bunks available for people, quote, with disabilities. They can stay there up to 3 weeks only. But, she says, in addition, all shelters will not allow anyone with a felony or sexual offender to stay there at all. And I can understand why, but this is very important. She says it makes it harder for deaf individuals because they have a felony background, or for sex offenders to find a place to stay, even temporary. And those rules were effective as of January 2020. So I don't know if any of you know about that. That's what she told me.
The felony thing is not a requirement. I mean, people can be in shelter with felonies. And as far as sex offenses, they're not supposed to have level 3 sex offenders in there, but they can have level 1 and I believe level 2. Mm. Is level 2 iffy? I know that they can have level 1s. For sure not level 3. I'm going to have to get back to you on level 2.
It might be case by case on level 2.
It might. But those two on either end, I know for sure.
Thank you. So you said the first and second level felonies, they're not as extreme, so those are terrible. And sexual offenders could be allowed to be in the shelters?
Yes, it's a lower level. Level 3 is an absolute no. And then the felony, I don't know if shelters also screen out the same felonies that others utilize, like arson and manufacturing.
I don't think they screen out arson.
I wouldn't think so, just based on... Well, I know
I
been
worked,
in shelter.
I haven't worked in shelter in 10 years, so they didn't when I was there.
Yeah.
So.
Well, they're not running background checks on people when they enter shelter.
No, they do run.
If they're going, maybe not
for
single men,
they
but
do for the,
they do for
sex,
families.
Sex crimes.
Yeah, for
but
sex crimes, yeah. But not for felonies.
Correct.
Yeah.
Good. So I'll make sure and talk to them about that. I appreciate it. If you know anything else and you want to email me about that before my meeting, that'd be wonderful. But I'm going to be talking to them. What do we, the deaf community, what do we think we can do about nobody's interested because maybe funding, or maybe because we haven't enough shelters? They're not going to change the definition of homeless. How do we make sure that this huge crisis we have of the house hoppers is addressed so that they can get in the system to get a place to live to?
Are there any specific barriers beyond kind of the norm to housing that you feel like they're having? Is it just income? Is it background? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm going to ask them those questions, or the awesome questions to ask. From my understanding, having in the past worked at Tillicum with clients and asking questions before, I say that one of the barriers is because you're deaf and your culture is that you house hop, automatically they don't want to even see you anyway, so you're done. But another barrier could be for us, like I can't accept people into my home because I inherited my mom's cat when she died, and the cat doesn't like dogs, and this one particular woman has a service dog. So it's very hard to find housing when even it's a service dog. They will say, you know, and shelters may not like it too much either. I don't know about that.
Shelters let them in.
I didn't think they could deny service animals at all. I mean, deaf if you're deaf. I'll just say that. So we, in general, in the deaf community, there's a lot of ADA laws, but people can get around them. They
sure.
have ways of doing that.
Absolutely.
And that's why we have a lot of people, that's one of the reasons why we have a lot of people without a job due to violation of the ADA law, because it has no teeth. And they know that a deaf person probably doesn't have a lot of money, and they're not going to get a lawyer. And if they have a company, they have lawyers. So there's a lot of discrimination that is making deaf people homeless. And then I know for a fact, unfortunately, Vancouver is known to deaf people. They send people here who like drugs. And I don't know if it's because we're good at recovery or it's because we have lots of drugs for them. So that's another thing, is people are moving here because they're told Vancouver is a place to have drugs. So then we have a lot of addiction here.
I don't know if I would agree with that. That sounds like it might be perpetuating some kind of myth or stereotype. I don't know if there's... Yeah.
No, in the deaf community, we do things like that. We will say to people, word of mouth, go here if you want this, go here if you want that. For example, Austin, Texas, they have 30 deaf-owned businesses. So we see somebody who's very bright and they want to set up a business, we might say go to Austin. So we do that.
Isn't this have like, I know there's a blind school.
Yeah, the blind,
but isn't
deaf.
This, I know this is over deaf, but isn't that like only one
right
here? Like,
in
I know this
state.
A long time ago, I lost somebody had to travel way far. It comes to the school to blind, but.
I think it is the only school, state school, isn't it?
It's the only state school, but I swear that I know of another deaf school in Washington State up north. But yeah, this WSD was set up before this was a state, and originally it had the blind and it had people with mental problems too. They separated those people, and it was just the deaf blind, and they met on the campus where he's now for the deaf, and then the blind separated and got their own campus later. So a lot of the buildings are kind of run down because they haven't really funded the deaf school so much. But one of the reasons we have a lot of deaf people here also is WSD. When hearing families, usually 90% of deaf people have hearing parents, move here to put their kid in that deaf school because it's closer, you know, then they, a lot of times those kids will just stay here. But then again, sometimes they'll grow up and they'll say, well, if I'm really smart and I'm really good at business and there's nothing here for me, I'm going to move away. So then we end up having all these people here that are being discriminated against that may have additional disabilities like deaf-blind, deaf cerebral palsy, et cetera, et cetera. And so they end up being the homeless people. It's unfortunate, and we're trying to figure out how we can resolve this.
So my earlier question was less about how what are the challenges to accessing the homeless crisis response system, and more about, because you mentioned specifically that you might have someone house hopping who offers to pay someone's entire rent.
Yeah.
And so is the challenge for someone like that maybe not income, but just having a hard time with the whole looking for housing process?
I think it's a combination of things. I don't want to speak for other people, but this particular person, they have a job, they're willing to pay the rent, but they have a dog, and not everybody can have a dog. So
mm-hmm.
if they come to me and they say, can I stay with you? I said, I don't want to tell you to give up your dog. You need your dog, but I can't have the dog in my place.
Sounds like each individual would have... an assessment of what their barriers are, but it sounds
yes.
like the navigation center would have someone to help with homeless prevention, or if someone's
homeless, but they're low barrier in terms of the income requirements or some of the other things that may prevent them from getting into housing. But David, your original point, I think, is really strong and well taken, that systemically within the system, they want to provide funding for the most vulnerable, chronically homeless. And even in education, you know, there's two different definitions than what housing and urban development has as for homeless. So couch surfing or house hopping is potentially putting people in a vulnerable situation because they don't have permanent homes. But I think in order to change it, I think you're doing the right thing, but I think it would take some legislative action to kind of identify that there are certain populations that are experiencing this at higher rates, and it needs to be targeted and funding needs to be earmarked to help them get into housing or having assistance. Mm-hmm. So I think you're doing good work. We appreciate the update. I do feel like it is like you have to, that has happened a lot in homeless shelters too, you like have to be at the worst of the worst in order to get help, even if, so you kind of have to plunge to the bottom in order to get lifted up.
Oh yes.
When you didn't really need to go there in the first place, all you needed was a little bit of help. So I think that's an issue that I'm glad you're addressing. And
well, I don't know if they want to maybe talk to the Housing Solutions Center or Kate or Melissa, because there is currently a couch surfing program specifically for people in that situation.
Well, all I can say is that that particular one, plus all the other clients that have been sent to the Council of the Homeless, every single one of them are turned away if they are, quote, couch surfing.
Is the program new?
I mean, it's really been around for, I want, at least since last summer.
So it's fairly new, so maybe the
it
experience.
Is. And they're really more kind of like prevention/diversion funds. So they help people who are couch surfing get into a place. So they'll provide like application fees, deposits, things like that.
I know there's also state, so the insurance, state insurance is now helping pay for people to find housing. I know that Community Services Northwest and Lifeline both do that, and possibly Columbia River Mental Health. And you do not have to be homeless. There are some eligibility criteria, such as homelessness may be one
imminent
factor
risk
in your eligibility, but not necessarily the defining factor. So the thing is, though, is I don't know the criteria for the different programs.
Well,
like,
so for FCS, there's got to be disability, homelessness, or risk of homelessness.
Well, you don't have to be homeless. Homelessness
no,
is one of
imminent
it
risk
is
of homelessness is one.
There's a scoring
yeah.
system. So, but I don't know how that you get in the program. So if you know somebody.
So ours comes from coordinated entry.
Okay, so ours may or may not come.
Yeah.
We can do internal referrals. I don't know if your guys' system does that or not.
It's iffy at this moment.
So we should be encouraging the people who have FCS Amerigroup capabilities to start opening that for their clients, because that might overlap into some of your
I think also just making sure that these systems are connecting, right? So that Tillicum and they call her CEO, is that what they call her?
Yes, CEO
yeah.
or director.
Yeah, so making sure that Tillicum is connected to coordinated entry and that those systems are talking to each other and knowing what the needs are.
So
yes, I do definitely. And to add something, they actually had a vote and they're changing the name, so it's not going to be Tillicum.
I know.
Another
I heard
so
that.
So you know more about it later.
When they get referred from Council on the Homeless, do they have to be homeless and they get referred to Community Services Northwest for FCS approval?
If they go to coordinated entry,
they
yes.
do.
So we've got it's mm-hmm. gone kind of back and forth. I think like two or three times about whether they have to come through coordinated entry or not.
And that's part of the problem, too, is for a deaf person to know how to get through any system. One of the problems to even be in the shelters itself, you know, communicating with people. What are the rules? What must they follow? Are they going to get kicked out? That's a whole other situation with anybody who is a linguistic minority that is homeless.
Yeah.
And so, but that's a completely different topic. So I appreciate what you're saying. I know Tillicum is pretty much on the ball on this because they have most of their clients are homeless. Mm-hmm. But just the same, would you email me all the information that you just said? It was,
yeah.
And so that way I can go research.
Yes.
And I can contact Kate and maybe talk with her before my meeting and say, clarify, is it still this way? They're still going to be excluded? Or is there a new thing that happened in summer that they need to know about? Yeah.
I can also tell you that the new assessment, the coordinated assessment group just kind of revamped the housing assessment. And that assessment specifically calls out whether or not someone has some kind of a hearing or vision disability that makes them vulnerable, whereas the previous one did not. So we're capturing some things that we were not previously.
Is there somewhere that somebody contacts before they're homeless besides just the homeless?
Counselor homeless.
Yeah. Is there somewhere else? Because I know right now, 21 people that are going to be homeless, 10 of them will be homeless on the 8th. A lot of these are children. But and then the other ones will be homeless at the beginning of April. But they all have homes today. But they're all going to be homeless.
I would connect with their schools for sure. The FCRC is at the school.
If they're accessing any services, from, they should talk to their service provider in case they have special programs. Mm-hmm.
So as a point of privilege, I would like to ask this committee, since this is my first meeting that I'm chairing, if you would be comfortable if I made some suggestive edits to our agenda, to Rebecca and to Janet. What if we remove the times from our agenda, move our guest presenters to the beginning of our meetings so they can come, do their presentation, and then once those are over, we can move on to our standard business? And then I'm not sure, if we're running an efficient meeting and we're using parliamentary procedures, do you think we need 2 hours for these meetings? That would be a question I would pose to Rebecca and Michael. Like, is this a meeting where we could schedule it from 9 to 9:30? And then maybe as we get into the presentations on giving awards for funding, maybe our meetings need to be a little longer. I'm on a lot of boards, and not very many are a two-hour board meeting.
The board members would be able to speak better to this, but because they're every other month, I felt like I've heard that the meetings are generally packed for the full 2 hours.
No. They have been so far for me. This is the first one that we've run kind of short.
So the first time I've chaired, I'm too curt.
Give it a minute, Alicia.
One consideration might be for having guest presentations speak earlier in the program. It's a parking situation that we have out there also.
I do agree with the earlier presentation part.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so we'll make that suggestion to the county team. So we'll just kind of juggle this a little bit, rearrange it. We'll keep the time and maybe reassess mid-year to see if until, like, I guess if a meeting ends early, it ends early. At least it's marked on our calendars.
So. Well, would you guys would prefer to move to 1 hour monthly instead of 2 hours every other month?
No.
Sorry. But thank you for the suggestion.
Good try, Sam.
Make it weekly. 15 minutes every hour. <Yeah, you're laughs>
<right. laughs>
So, Jay is here.
Wonderful. Hi, welcome. We're running ahead of schedule.
And Peggy is parking.
So. Oh, good. So, we could have to get your presentations.
We're set up and
ready. Do you guys want to wait for Peggy or have her sit through the presentation? Probably wait for Peggy. Probably nice.
Let's wait.
Yeah. So if we want to take just a 5-minute break, use the restroom, get coffee, and then we'll adjourn again at 8:50. Yes? Yeah? All right. Good. Might go get a latte.
Right down. Yeah.
I'm just going to do it because I didn't do that. It's crazy.
So, okay, I mean, that was great visual.
Yes.
But it's like,
it's
a little
so
too
practical. Yeah. It's really funny.
But,
it's on the committee,
no,
if you've got a bill that's being heard and passed, it's insanity. It's crazy.
I heard that it's not going to happen on that because it's explain. Because there's a lot of people that, you know, first of all, everybody's
Sometimes it's just
an English word, someone who can't do that. Not a bad idea.
So I'm here to talk about the Affordable Housing Fund. So we just, today we're releasing a RFQ for the section of the Affordable Housing Fund that provides rental assistance and services. And we that fund generates $6 million a year, and $1.5 million is dedicated for rental assistance and services. So little background is, when the fund was created, City Council created an admin and finance plan, and it divides the fund into four different categories. And the category that's just being released today we call it homelessness prevention. And this will be the third RFQ for that specific fund. And what we've done is we've rolled in the 2019 dollars into that and the 2020 dollars. So the RFQ is for $3 million, and we would want the $3 million to be spent over 2 years. All of what the city does for the Affordable Housing Fund mirrors the city's CDBG and home processes. So the process that we've used is folks apply online through Zoom grants, and we have a separate committee that looks at those applications and prioritizes them. Then City Council makes the final decision on who receives the funding.
What's that you applied through?
Pardon?
What was the website?
Zoom grants. And I can, I was trying to print out we had a little bit of trouble with the connection, so I couldn't print out the actual press release, but I'll send that over to you all sometime today, so you'll be able to click right on it and get into the application. So that's good news. We have City Council awarded the funding for the expansion of shelters in January. And we're working on those contracts right now. And it was a contract for Exchange Recovery, which will be providing, the city hasn't worked with them in the past, but they are they operate under a peer model, and it's drug and alcohol free. And they are opening up three houses with a total of 15 beds that people that are chronically homeless will have access to. Also awarded funding to SHARE. Some of you might be aware that St. Luke's right now operates as a shelter for women, and it is overnight only. Mm-hmm. And so SHARE has asked for funding to let the women stay there during the day. So it'll be a 24-hour shelter.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it'll be a great relief for those women. We also awarded funding to the St. Paul's, what St. Paul's is going to do is, right now St. Paul's just serves men, and they serve men only through the 5 months out of the year during the WHO, and the city has awarded them funding to expand their services to all year.
Oh, nice.
How much of the $6 million, Peggy, was earmarked for the shelter portion?
So the shelter portion is all separate. So it is only $300,000 a year. And we added some additional some other dollars to that funding. We had 2 years worth of funding and added some additional dollars that we hadn't spent on implementation. And we'll be sending out we're in mid-cycle. So the Affordable Housing Fund was authorized and beginning in January 2017. So we are and it was for 7 years, $6 million for 7 years. So we're right in the mid-cycle of it. And we're putting out a mid-cycle report that'll be out this month as well.
Do you happen to know if Exchange, so typically they have run a recovery house model kind of similar to Oxford, where people who live there have to pay rent. Are they opening up these houses to run like shelter, where people do not have to pay to be there, or are they running them like their regular Exchange houses where people have to pay?
We're still working on the details on all of that. I think that what they're asking for the city is money for, so people don't have to pay. that folks still, it is still, they still are operating a program that is drug and alcohol free.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just working on their contract, and we are not trying to get involved in their all their day-to-day activities.
Mm-hmm.
So they can still manage their program, but I believe it's just, it's to cover the cost of the fee. I think it's like $300, something like that. So we have, then we, on our website, we have a way that you can see where we're at with all the other projects, because we have, in 2019, we awarded, between CDBG and HOME and the Affordable Housing Fund, we awarded funding for 15 different projects in the community that are construction, or they, some of them were an actual purchase or rehab, and you can see the status of all those on our website. We have, I think, four that have were completed this in 2019 that are actually renting now. So, and we, the last round of construction dollars, which is the biggest pot of the portion of the money, we set aside $2 million that would be used to match with a project that's awarded tax credits through the state of Washington. And tax credits is the largest funding source in the U.S. that's used to construct affordable housing. So we felt that we wanted to be able to match some of that. And the Housing Trust Fund and the Washington State Housing Finance Commission has made their tentative announcements of who will get the funding, so we'll be looking at that to see which ones we can match, and then we'll be going out for another competitive round this spring for that portion of the money. So that's a lot. We've been doing a lot. We have a very engaged council, and ex-council too, that was helped put all that together, so we feel pretty fortunate. And do you folks have any questions?
I do have one more. Do you happen to know how many beds Exchange will be?
I believe it's 15.
I'm headed to Washington, D.C. on Sunday to go and talk to Congress about the tax credit.
Oh, increasing it.
Yeah, there's a couple things that the organization that the governor appoints members to for the tax credits, they have an opportunity to go back to Washington, D.C., and they have a conference and then work with them. And our own Senator Cantwell has been really a huge advocate in increasing the tax credit program and making sure we get more money in our state to leverage to build the affordable housing that you mentioned. So it's a good program. It's nice to see you doing that leveraging.
We're trying to. I mean, we've been trying to work it out, and we had a lot more since the city put together the Affordable Housing Fund. We had a lot more applicants go forward and ask for tax credits, both for 9% and 4%, than we've ever had. So they were totally overprescribed. And
I think in this first round, the commission, I just heard on Thursday, we had our meeting, they had almost $1 billion in requests.
Right.
I mean, and our whole amount is $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
just from Clark County. They had and what we try to do in Clark County is come together and figure out who can apply, and so we don't pit people against one another. But the requirement is that if you're going to apply, you have to ask the jurisdiction where your project is for that you're consistent with your consolidated plan, which governs the CDBG and HOME program. And so everybody did that like on the last day, and we did 10 different letters for folks that were interested in either 9% or 4% tax credits. So there's a lot of folks that are interested, so that if they were able to expand the tax credit program, that would be pretty amazing. So,
any questions for Peggy?
Any updates about the Navigation Center?
That's another good question. So the Navigation Center, right now the Parks Department is operating it. They're open every day. 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. They have consistently been seeing about 100 people a day. And when I talked to them last week, in the time from January to the end of February, they had 150 new folks that had never been to the Navigation Center before, that they hadn't seen at the Navigation Center. So that would, they started in November, so that's a lot. We solicited agencies that are interested, proposals from agencies that are interested in providing to operate there, and we have four proposals. We'll be making a decision on that by the end of this week. And y'all know Jackie St. Louis has left, and we opened up that position. We'll be doing interviews next week. So it's moving along. They're keeping busy. I don't know, have any of you been there
mm-hmm.
past couple of weeks? I'm sure you were probably there yesterday.
Yeah, I was.
So. Encourage you to stop by, say hi to the park staff, and check it out. So the park staff is there. Yeah, yeah.
I used an old photo from the Marshall Center. I was like,
great. So that's all I have for that. Any other? Great.
Thank you, Peggy. And just as a note, the board came to consensus. We'll be adjusting our agenda to have our presenters in the beginning of the meeting.
Oh, okay.
That way you don't have to sit through trying to time. So
oh, great.
Make it a little more predictable.
And easier to park.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I always like coming to these meetings. We just had an issue this morning that we got kind of tied up with. So.
Well, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah.
Appreciate
my pleasure.
It.
Thank you.
So we have Impact Northwest here, and they're going to provide us an overview and presentation on rapidly housing and permanent supportive housing programs. So welcome.
Thank you. All right, I didn't realize that there were more than 10 people at this meeting, so I apologize that some of you may have to share. The first flyer is kind of our one-page general, and then on the back side is what we give the Council for the Homeless in terms of eligibility, what our low barrier to entry into the program requirements are. I'm going to start with rapid rehousing. My name is RJ Stanglin, by the way, sorry, Assistant Director to our Housing and Safety Net Department at Impact Northwest. Little brief background, I started with Impact a little over 10 years ago as a direct service provider doing permanent supportive housing in Bridges Housing in Portland. It targeted families with children escaping DV. It was tied with a project-based voucher, but it came with the same kind of supportive services that has evolved into what we now call permanent supportive housing. I also have experience doing rapid rehousing up here in Clark when we first started back in 2013 with prevention, which then evolved into a focus on rapid rehousing. And now I really commend that you guys have really filled the toolbox with a little bit of prevention dollars for those that just need a little bit of help, focus on rapid rehousing to serve the most vulnerable that just need maybe a year to two to get really up to a new level and then graduate, and then a lot of focus on permanent support housing, either through building new home or new buildings that are dedicated or doing a similar project funded where we can master lease a place or we can give additional rent assistance so that someone in that who is literally the most vulnerable, has a long-term history of homelessness, and there's a long-term disability.
And then just for a point, there's two separate handouts.
Yeah.
One is permanent and one is rapid.
Yes, sorry about that. I thought giving one on each side,
that's
but
okay.
Yeah.
So I have a couple extra permanent supporters. Do you guys need this? Okay, thank you.
So I apologize if you were part of the CAB board when we gave our presentation for the RFQ last grant year. So this is just a brief overview of our rapid rehousing in Clark County. We had five programs. We also have the Support Services for Veterans program, which is a rapid rehousing program specifically tailored to veterans. And then we've had two permanent supportive housing, one being funded by Clark County, the other one funded by HUD. Our program fundamentals, and this is probably going to repeat when I get to the permanent supportive housing, because we believe the same fundamentals work for rapid rehousing as they do for permanent supportive housing. Really, the level of care is the only thing that really differs between the two programs. So we try to do a same-day referral or response to a referral because we know immediate contact to set up that intake for someone who's literally homeless is crucial. One, because contact points can change in a time. And also, we don't know their current living situation. Most likely, when they were called or they were referred from the Council for the Homeless, they were either staying in shelter, they were living in a place not meant for habitation, potentially couch surfing, but more or less, we want to make sure that they have a safe place to stay as we do the eligibility so that we can access the funding.
So you're part of the coordinated entry?
Oh, yes. All of our programs come from coordinated access through the Council for the Homeless.
Okay.
Even our prevention program that Peggy was talking about, which is an amazing program. So I really, that's great news because I was still like unsure if it was going to be refunded or not. So we do an expedited intake, meaning that we can go out into the field and do the intake with them if the barrier is really coming to our office, which is a shared space with partners and careers. We have work cell phones, so we can just take photos of pertinent documents to then print, put in the file so that we're audit proof. And then we'll do resource referral for immediate needs as we're then starting the housing search. Our service model is Housing First. For those that may not have a clear understanding what Housing First is, it's the newest principle of how to do housing services. 10 years ago, it was you had to be ready to be housed. You had to do rent well to learn how to be a good tenant. Even though I still think those are great values, the idea of Housing First is if someone who is in a traumatic space, and being homeless is traumatic, if you have children that are unsure if they're going to have a safe place to stay, is traumatic. So we're trying to minimize that time to get them into a place so that a sense of safety can be there, and then there can be a focus towards goal development to get to the next level, and ideally graduating so that income is increased to the point where their budget is now fully funded by their own sources of income, or in terms of supported housing, that they understand what a lease is, how to be a good tenant, and just excel through that. We're a strength-based, person-centered case management agency, meaning that we will walk with you, we will leverage your strengths, hopefully develop the weaknesses into strengths, and then allow the client to choose the direction because they're the experts in their lives. There's no success, and I learned this in my first year doing direct service. Telling people what to do is immediately, I hate you, RJ, I don't want to do this. To, hey, I understand you don't want to pay your rent, but what are the consequences? So we try, at the very least, we try to give the positive and negative consequences of choice and then allow people to make choices. I make bad choices, and I have the repercussions of it and hopefully learn from them. We also do progressive engagement, meaning we're meeting people at the level that they need for that particular point. Normally, at the beginning of the intake, it's intensive. We're meeting daily. We're probably having contact daily. We're going out in the field meeting landlords. We're advocating to landlords. We're putting in that deposit fee so we can lock in that apartment because the vacancy rate is so low still. We really want to get there. As people start developing their life and they have their goals being met, we kind of tailor back. Tailor back on rent assistance and wrap-free housing so that there's a little bit more pressure of this is the reality of paying full rent. So we'll most likely do 100% for a couple months. We'll tailor it down. Ideally, by graduation, we are paying zero rent assistance. We're giving additional resource referral information so that once graduation or exit plan happens, they are fully engaged with all the resources they need to be successful so they don't come back into the continuum. Impact Northwest has been a leader in the trauma-informed care movement, meaning that we believe everybody who engages with us, be it staff, be it community members, be it just people that walk in off the street, have experienced trauma to some degree. We want to be mindful of it so that as we're engaging, that if we see things are triggering people, that we step back so that we're not re-traumatizing. We find that if you can do this, you can build a lot more of a case manager client relationship and trust quicker. We're harm reduction, meaning that if there are unsafe things going on, that we try to reduce the potential for harm, either via safety planning for recovery, or if there's children, maybe coming up with a child care program to meet their needs. We also do barrier removal to housing barriers. We have a partnership with a screening company so that we right off the bat can do a background check and know exactly what's on the report, dispute things that possibly are incorrect, and then advocate with the potential landlord of, hey, this is what you're going to see. What can we do to potentially alleviate that so that we can get this person in under 30 days? We do landlord advocacy. I've done mediation. My staff team does mediation with landlords when certain things happen. A lot of times, landlords they'll have an issue. Landlords want two things. They want their rent on time, and they don't want problems. So if we can get people on board for that, we find success. Occasionally, unwelcome guests are coming in, and it becomes a community issue. So we've gone out there, and the greatest success is when the landlords see that the agency is bringing this additional support. It's like you're almost having a secondary property manager coming in, giving intensive support to ensure that their rules and community agreements are being met, and then our tenants and clients are maintaining their housing. And then lastly, at the very end, when someone graduates, we still follow up with them for at least a year. We've had some people call us after a year, but we try to do a 3-month, 6-month, 9-month, and 12-month just check-in in case something happens, because life happens. A lot of our partnerships are important because one agency cannot do this program. The Housing First model really takes all of these. Council for the Homeless is the coordinated access. They initially have done the outreach. They talked to the potential referral. They've done the assessment to know that they meet the threshold for the program. We've partnered with Partners in Careers because we do believe that employment is key. For those that are able to work, that employment is your way to be able to afford the housing when rent is going up. So they bring the employment piece to our model. We partner with YWCA because a lot of our single parent children have experienced DV or currently fleeing DV, so they're the experts in the DV system, so we want to make sure that they can get connected to them as needed. Clark County Volunteer Lawyers are our legal component, where they provide free legal counsel to remove housing barriers. They can write letters of reasonable accommodation to try to appeal a potential denial. We're also part of the Housing First Work Group, and then we partnered with a few property management companies that share a similar mission, because we found that if the landlord can buy in, they're going to build, or they'll give a lot more flexibility when certain things happen. And then if they see the quick response that we can bring, then they're even happier, especially when the outcome can just be, can you just check on this person, this has been going on, well, we'll be there today. And then we look for additional funding always, because as you can tell from contracts, certain funds like to pay for certain things, but life has all different expenses. And one little thing, that $40 to cover transportation for a bus for a couple months could change someone's ability to have a job or get children to school or whatnot. So in our current wrap rehousing, we propose to serve 10 literally homeless households. We're currently at 9. We're probably going to go over because we have additional funding to spend by the end of June. So my guess is we'll probably serve around 12. It is a 2-year contract, so 11 of those 12 will roll over to next grant year to some degree. Some may graduate early next year. We've had one graduate so far. Everyone else has maintained their housing and are still engaged. The one that graduated had a great successful plan of increasing income through employment and also having her father move in to help with the child care and bring some fixed income to the total household. So that was great. So we always want to ensure that everyone can maintain or increase the income. We have a 90, 85, 80 follow-up. Right now we're at the 6-month for them, and so it's 100% one for one so far for 6 months, still successful. We do always want to try to increase income for every household, because in wrap rehousing, because it really isn't indefinite permanent, there is going to be an exit date. And if you're not increasing income and rent keeps going up or cost of living keeps going up, it will be moving out and coming back to the system. We also want to increase financial literacy. I personally believe, and I've done this from direct service to now and advocate to my staff and teach them, budgeting. Everyone lives on a budget. It doesn't matter if you only have $300 to your name every month or if you're Bill Gates or Bezos and have a billion. You live on a budget, and knowing where your money is empowers you. All right, our permanent supportive housing. We call it Homes for Good because we want to make sure that this is your home for as long as you want to be in this program. We've done the Homes for Good, which is the HUD-funded program, for now almost 6 years. We have served now, I believe, there's still 16 currently we have 7 that are in, and we have 3 openings that we will be opening this spring. We have 2 master lease apartments that are available. We just had a few staff turnovers so that we have to hire to be able to serve the extra to the level of care that we need. We don't want to just take a referral and then just leave them hanging. So we hope by end of March, early April, we'll have the extra 3, and that will bring us to our HUD output of 10 household, individual households served. The PSH Local, which is funded by you guys, Clark County, we propose to serve 4 households of varying demographics. It could be individuals, it could be households. If you look on the back side, the back side, it will show the target populations that you guys have deemed the priority. Right now we have 1 individual and 2 households with minor children. And we'll be opening up, or we have opened up a new referral to Council for the Homeless for another one. So we're waiting for that, which will meet our output. PSH Local also helps us fund our PSH HUD because of the match requirement for HUD. So the local funding helps us support the additional 10 that we get HUD funding every year. So it's crucial that these 2 mirror each other. And then in another program, which is a HUD one, we've served 13 households annually. We're about 4 years, and it's only a 2-year program in that one. And by graduation, our goal, even though it is perma support housing, this was such an older program that they did put a cap on it. So our fundamentals are similar. We can do a mobile intake. We do safety planning. We do immediate response to crises. We try to, especially with PSH, because we're not mental health specialists, we're not recovery specialists, we really are building the partnerships to get those connections for those struggling with those things. We definitely do continual landlord engagement because we found that PSH tends to be a little bit harder, especially for when someone is chronically homeless, meaning they've been homeless for over a year, or they've had a year's worth of homeless episodes in the last 4 episodes in the last 3 years. So there's a lot of transition from living on the street or in a place not meant for habitation for over a year and going into a community or an apartment complex with neighbors. So in the first, like I said, in the first few months or maybe even 6 months of the first year, we're constantly going out there, weekly contact with the landlord. We want to check in that to hear both sides of the story to ensure that that person will be successful, and if little things do pop up, we're there to tell the consequences of choice. The biggest challenge is the, for lack of a better word, guilt of your friend still being on the street and you being lucky to be in a place and having your friends access your housing, which then potentially jeopardizes your housing. So teaching people how to set boundaries is part of our management model. We do mediation as needed. And then emergency basic need. We also, in this program, because it's housing first, if someone is unsuccessful, and same with rapid rehousing, and we can move them out and minimize the barriers, we will actively find a new place. We'll talk about why that housing situation wasn't successful, but especially in households that have minor children or multiple people, if there's another episode of housing or you're stressed about losing housing and not knowing what's next, that's the next traumatic event, which will bring you back into the system longer. So if we can take away that gap and go, yeah, okay, so this situation didn't work that well, let's find a place that does work for your needs and what you're able to agree with in terms of community rules, guest policy, potentially smoking policy, pet policy. So we're always actively looking for landlords that are willing to give a second chance. And we have moved a couple people into different apartments, and that second chance has maintained for years. So again, service model is the same as rapid rehousing. Housing first with barrier removal. Trauma-informed care, harm reduction. As I said, strength-based, person-centered. And then we do try to do tenant education, life skill development, and community involvement. Because we also know a lot of people that have been chronically homeless, they move into a new housing community, isolation becomes a crucial issue. So the more activities or community involvement that someone can be, the better a chance someone will be successful in their new housing opportunity. Partnerships are the same. For our HUD funded, because it's master leasing, it really does take a partnership with the landlord or the property owner, because Impact is the one leasing the apartment and then we sublease to our tenant. Ideally, HUD wanted us to do zero barrier to entry. I found it very difficult to negotiate that with landlords, but we've compromised to, we will still, you guys still do the background check on the potential tenant, but just trust that we will be there to support you, and that seems to work currently. So as I said, our output for PSH Local is 14. Currently, we are at 11, and we will have three more openings for HUD, which will help support the total output. Target population, again, chronically homeless, if you want to look on the back. This program does require long-term disabilities. Someone in the household does have to be the adult. It could be a minor child. And then underserved veterans, survivors of DV, IPV, and SA, and then persons in any stage of addiction recovery. Our outcomes are 100% will maintain increased income. We want 100% that will exit, retain the permanent housing. The great thing with permanent supportive housing is it's very rare that someone exits, because we can continually give the support that they need to ensure their long-term housing. The few times people have exited it, it's normally a plan to move out of the service area, either with a relative. The one person who just graduated last October, she was fleeing DV because the abuser found where she lived and she didn't feel safe remaining here. So we came up with a plan to move her to Texas where her mom lives. And the YWCA was amazing, by the way, because they were able to leverage funds to buy a one-way airplane ticket, which we were able to get that day. 90% will engage with health and wellness services. We always, when we do an intake, we do our own assessment to know what benefits have been accessed and which are still there. So we ensure everyone has medical insurance if they don't by the time they come into our program. And then 80% will remain stable in housing for at least a year. I'll say right now, except for the newest PSH Local referral, all PSH clients, HUD and Local, have remained in housing for multiple years. In some cases, we still have a client who's over 5 years now. All right, that's the quick version. Any questions? Sure.
Could you speak a little bit about the difference in your rent structure, or how you allocate rent subsidy between rapid rehousing and permanent supportive housing?
So the model for rapid rehousing is we do a tiered rent assistance program where with progressive engagement, we typically will pay 100% of the move-in costs. We'll typically do 100% of the rent for 3 months. Maybe there's a reason why we extend that to 6 months, but then we try to go with 70%, 50%, 30%. So that it tiers down, so that by the time income has gone up and our rent assistance has gone down, they are able to cover full rent utilities or be connected to resources to cover those bills when they exit our program. PSH Local, our standard is, will help with the move-in costs. We typically would pay 100% of the rent at the beginning, and then our calculation is that the tenant pays 30% of their income minus a utility allowance.
And then one more follow-up.
Sure.
So it seems to be there's lots of graduation and success with rapid rehousing in terms of at the end of their time frame not coming back into the system.
The goal is that they don't come back into the system within 2 years, and there's been great success in the last few years.
What would you attribute, not even what would you attribute, but where do you see the majority of those that graduate go on to? Are they moving on to maybe a transitional housing program? Are they getting a Section 8 voucher? Are they being housed on their own? What would you...
It's a mix. If I had to say what would be the most successful, again, life is all variables. If a referral comes in with the ability to increase employment opportunity, have a full-time job, that is one success route. The other is get into rapid rehousing and put your name on potentially the Section 8 wait list. And then rapid rehousing will work with you until your name comes up to a longer-term subsidy as needed.
Okay.
Really, you don't see rapid rehousing then transitioning into a transition housing program. It's normally the reverse.
Okay.
And the individuals that are in the programs stay in the residence that they're initially...
They
not moving to another...
No, in the wraparound housing, they're signing their own lease. We are just advocating the landlord that we will bring the support and rental assistance as needed to ensure stability. Sure.
So I represent the deaf community. I was wondering, first of all, do you get deaf clients?
I don't believe we have, but we've had employees that have American Sign Language ability, and really, we don't choose who we serve. We have Counsel for the Homeless. I will say, on a side note, we have had languages that we currently don't have interpreters for, so we partnered with Linguava to do in real live interpretation as needed. So if we did have that need, we'd be able to have someone come in to provide the language, or American Sign Language.
I was wondering what you would do, because if you had deaf clients, and I was saying in your PowerPoint, you were training them how to do stuff, that could be a little problem.
No, it would. I don't have a lot of experience working with the deaf community, but I would think that it would be more effective to have their language to be represented, especially in an education format, and understanding leases and community rules.
Do you ever get referrals on your rapid rehousing program for clients who are on fixed incomes who can't work and increase their income?
So we do. We have a few of them are on TANF, a single parent with children. Those tend to be a little more challenging in terms of finding a child care plan so that income can increase. The other one will be Social Security. Normally, when it's a fixed income, we're trying to educate the potential risk of a fund, like our rental assistance program ends. What is your plan? So we're not trying to move someone into a housing opportunity, which potentially could fail later on. Mm-hmm. So if someone had a fixed income, we're really looking for that unicorn landlord who has a one-bedroom house for $450 a month. But yeah, we have those conversations. And they sometimes are challenging, but as I said, the one success, she moved her dad in with her fixed income. Mm-hmm. Her outside employment income was enough to maintain her one-bedroom apartment. So we get creative with the rental market and limitations like fixed income.
This might be a very naive question. When you mentioned that people have developed relationships when they were living outside and then they want to bring their friends into their housing, why can't they have roommates and get two people off the streets?
So we don't define who the household is. They're able to define, if they have a friend and they define themselves as a household, we would serve them as a household. The challenge becomes if they identify as, let's say in this example, an individual, and we serve them, we move them in, and then they want their friend to move in with them. We'll advocate to the landlord, but that means that they also have to pass the eligibility or the screening background of the landlord. It's not that we can just move them in. Right. People can define what their household is. And yes, bringing in a roommate to help with the cost of living is a great plan. Yes.
RJ, thanks. I really appreciate the presentation.
Thank you.
Particularly the kind of results you've been getting with outcomes and whatnot. My question goes to the heart of deliverables, and particularly how to leverage what you're doing. To me, this is something that ought to be done on a scale of 10 to 20, what is being done now.
Yeah.
And so what is it that is a barrier to your organization in terms of moving to greater capacity? Then secondly, how might the community look at ways to leverage what you're doing?
So in terms of advocating for a housing first model, I think the best thing to look into, and I thought Rebecca was going to be here because we just had a conversation about this, the cost of someone being on the street accessing resources and emergency resources on the street costs dramatically more. I've seen some estimates where it's three times the cost of someone on the street for police, medical, emergency, versus a permanent supportive housing, which can cost as low as 12 months of rent and maybe case management, which could be about $20,000 versus $60,000 a year. In terms of what we need in this community, and I would say in probably all major communities, is more affordable housing. Because if someone, and a lot of the population, do have fixed incomes, and when fixed income can't even cover what a month of rent is, let alone the idea when I was growing up, my parents taught me, if you're paying more than 25% of your income for housing, you need to find something else. Mm-hmm. We're at the point now where we're trying to leverage 50% of your income as the threshold, and that is tough. So I would say that investing in more housing, advocating to landlords and property managers to be part of this mission, because as I said, the ones that we have found that have adhered to the mission that we're bringing, they give the flexibility, they have the understanding and compassion, so that they do want to have people be successful. The big bad corporate portfolio manager who is just pay the move-in fee, let's evict them and take them to court, get the money, and flip the unit, those are the places we don't want to work with. If we could convince them to get on board, that'd be great, because the portfolio managers own multiple major dense buildings. And then lastly, I would say neighbor outreach, because there's always the kind of preconceived notion of a homeless person comes with this baggage. It's been shown that someone that has the support as case managers, mental health workers, they're more successful at maintaining their housing than Joe Public renting a private unit. So having these preconceived notions be challenged and then bring the data can open up the community to really invest in what's needed here. Thank you for your question. All right, anything else? And I really like do presentations first.
Nice.
Traffic would have been a lot easier. And parking.
Yeah, thanks for that feedback.
Good job.
Yeah, all right, thank
very
you.
Very nice presentation. Thank you, RJ.
Thank you.
I learned a lot. Great. So this is the time on our agenda where we have an open forum, so it gives the public an opportunity to present or ask questions of the board. So we do have one guest with us today. Mark, do you want 3 minutes to present or address
sure.
the board?
Sure, and just buzz me if I hit 3.
Okay, I will. I'll put my timer on.
She has experience.
I really will use my timer.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the opportunity to be here. I was very attracted to the agenda that you had today and wanted to come and see what CAAB has been doing. I'm a good friend with Lydia Sanders, who is your former chair, and we're working very closely with her on a couple of projects. So I mentioned my background. I guess I would say that I've been on this journey around community capacity building, around community security is what I characterize it, for about 20 years. And that came out of my 20-some years working in the federal government and then leaving that in the mid-90s and starting to do some consulting work. And really that focus was around strategic alliances to build community capacity. So part of my focus is looking at what is the system, how is it operating, and then how can the community as a resource be mobilized to be an agent of that change. So I was on Community Choices 2010. Board for a number of years, and we worked in a couple of arenas along those lines. I've been on the Open House Ministry Board, the Homeless Family Shelter, for almost 20 years now. And RJ's description of their program and their results is very similar to one of the reasons I've stayed on that board as long as I have, is just how it's transformed itself and built capacity. It faces very similar sort of challenges, and as a board, we're looking at how to move that forward. Our organization, Americans Building Community, is a small nonprofit community development corporation. Its whole focus is on neighborhood revitalization in the Fourth Plank Quarter. So we set the boundaries of our operations, a place-making entity between I-5 and 205, and working with those 7 neighbors. That's our focus. It doesn't mean we don't do things in other settings, but in terms of our particular investments, we're targeting those neighborhoods here in the quarter. Security-wise, we operate in 3 arenas: housing security, food security, and job security. And a big piece of that is tied to creating new models for building capacity in those arenas. So we did a low-income homeownership project with a city home grant back in 2010, and we partnered with Southwest Washington Community Land Trust to create what we felt was a great example of how do you create an opportunity for people to become low-income homeowners, and that being a mechanism to move people from poverty to the middle class, however it might look. And then in the food systems arena, we've done a lot of work around neighborhood gardens, and particularly using that as a vehicle to not only create a place where people can access affordable, healthy food choices, but more importantly, to build relationships in the neighborhood. So our adage with our neighborhood gardens is, you live within a 5-minute wheelbar walk, you're a candidate for our neighborhood garden. We want to build relationships that extend beyond food production into being more connected and overcoming some of the isolation and insulation that's a big part of our culture. And then in the job security arena, we're doing a lot of work around mobilizing systems to be agents that really facilitate the throughput, that move people that are either young people wanting to get into the trades or people in their life transition, helping to facilitate their access to the system. So a big part of our agenda is systems integration and expansion into the grassroots arena. Our vision is creating a community where connection is norm and all talents matter, because we believe all the assets you need in a place are already there. The challenge is, how do you connect with them and how do you mobilize them, equip them so they can be a part of change in the community. And then our mission is transforming neighborhoods one heart at a time. We just believe that it's relationship that moves things. So the focus is on the people that are there, and our agenda is to create a great place to live, learn, work, and play. And so I want to talk a little bit more, just a minute or so, about what's happening in the housing arena. This is an amazing community in terms of how it's coming together. It's really at a stage now where it needs to start getting a little more sophisticated. Last Monday, I went to the Vancouver Housing Authority's Vancouver Affordable Housing Nonprofit. It was their quarterly meeting, made up of a lot of folks like you. And it was striking to me how they were going for a similar process that you all are going through, in terms of learning and trying to understand what's so. And we shouldn't have to do it that way. We should be able to take a look at something that defines what the current situation is and helps guide our investments and guide those investments in a way that starts to generate the kind of results we want to see. So programs like what RJ is doing and whatnot, other entities, how do you facilitate that in a way that everybody can be a part of the solution? So my recommendation for you is that you bring together a task force, that you be a part of a task force, the committee-wide, that really looks at how to create a systems map, a systems asset map. These things that you've been talking about today, those should already have been mapped out. You should have been able to have that map in front of you, and as people are talking about things, you're seeing on that map exactly who's investing what where, and you're seeing what sort of results are playing out. So on one end of the spectrum, you have a person, let's just go with the housing arena, that's not housed, or is at risk of being housed. So you've got two components of that. And then you look at the touch points where that person come through, and at the other end of the game, they're a person that is in secure housing. And they are becoming an asset to the community because now they're not at risk, and they're able to bring their own personal giftings to bear. So you did a beautiful job talking about what's the consequence of not having that structure in place. So what would be the consequence if we were to have it? And how do we get very clear about that? That agenda has to be mobilization of people. If you've seen the Portland State University report on their homelessness research that they did, they will be very direct with you at the end of the game, at the end of the presentation, saying, we're not going to build ourselves out of this. There's not enough money in the world to fix this problem. So what does that mean? Do we just live with the problem for the rest of our lives? No. It means we've got to look at different ways to solve the problem. I think one of those key ways is that we start to build the capacity of people in those communities to be agents that facilitate it. It doesn't take away the role of a system. The system's critical. So you've got to have that weaving together of resources and intentionality to make sure you're doing the right thing and you're doing it the right way. But there are a lot of people out in our communities that have the capabilities and capacity to move if we can set the system structure that will support that in place. So I think you are at a key place. I think for you to get together with the Vancouver Affordable Housing Nonprofit, they're in the same place. But we really are at a point now we need to come together and sit down and say, what is the system play that we're going to move this thing forward? Work we're doing with the Middle Class Alliance, three arenas we're operating in, Live, Learn, and Link this year. Live is all about mobilizing the industry, the marketplace, to become an agent of affordable housing generation. That's a big, tall order, but it's a critical one, because if we can't figure out how to get the market to be a part of the agenda of housing everybody, that's a tall order. I mean, talk about not having money. So we're in the midst of a great project with BIA right now that is involved in not only apprenticeship learning, but focusing that apprenticeship capacity building around investing people to become producers of affordable housing. In the learn arena.
Would you have like an electronic document or something that you could share with the board?
Yes,
so
I could send that to you,
that
Lisa. So Lisa's been to a couple of our meetings and we've talked on a number of cases around this. So, but this is a grassroots coalition of folks. Tim Probst is leading that group. I'm the vice chair. And we just have an amazing number of talented people that are working in the live, learn, and link arena. Thirdly, I would say that...
we have about one more minute.
Yes, that's good. Faith Partners for Housing, we're working on a shared housing model. We've been working on that for about 2.5 years now. We were going to partner with Metro HomeShare, which has a long history of a very successful program. They're very busy now building their capacity in Clackamas, but we're moving forward with that agenda. So we think that's a big part of the solution, particularly the preventive solution. And ultimately to being part of the rapid rehousing solution as we build people's competencies and capabilities to be successful in housing people that they normally would never have considered. So that's my whole event for you, is to look at how do you build your capacity. And we as a community need to get on the same page. We need to create an asset map that really defines who are the players, how are those investments playing out, what kind of contributions are they making to the outcomes. And then every meeting you sit here and you look and say, well, how did that contribute to what our agenda is?
All right, so. Thank you, Mark, very
Thanks.
Much. Thank you. I know that Michael had passed out at a previous meeting, kind of on something similar to what Mark just mentioned, which was an asset mapping with all of the funding and what programs are receiving it, what their intended outcomes are. So maybe revisiting that as a refresher would be helpful for this board.
Be a good foundation for this.
Absolutely.
I'd like to say, I think that we recognize with the crisis that's coming with housing over the years that it's a community problem. And we just have to unite the community. But it's been difficult to get a hold of all the pieces. And you see the faith community coming forward. You see private groups like that coming forward. People want to help. They just don't know where and how to get connected. And I think the communities that we're seeing that are being very successful have done exactly what Mark's talking about. They have... they know what their assets are, they know who the providers are, and they know who the people are in need. And they're name-based, they come into a system, and there's a monthly whatever meeting where people are saying, okay, how can we track their progress? Who can jump in here at what place? Where are the gaps? You know, we are a small enough community with enough resources that we could manage that. But we need someone, and maybe this is the group, that just pulls everything together, but it really... maybe this isn't a group. It really has to be community-based also. I think so often in the community, if they see a system taking care of it, then people think it's taken care of. So somehow we have to take the message to our community, and we know how generous our community is and how willing they are to be involved, but we need to put together some kind of a system that tracks our assets and tracks the needs.
So that was also started, because Michael he's got that great graphic of, and it looks confusing because there's so many pieces, but that's kind of a very high-level view at funding. And at the last Homeless Ideas Group meeting that Jackie St. Louis led, he kind of walked everybody through this, looking at a systems level, what are all of our assets here? And he kind of broke it down, what we all did as a part of the group, all of the various assets. There was a little... smaller level, more local level. So I'm wondering if maybe we can't.
Yeah,
Jane,
I think you're right
together.
On the point. There are so many of those attempts cradled in institutional frames.
Yeah.
How do we expand it into a community frame so those institutions can start to see the interface? And it is complex. So
it is.
In my mind, it has to be an image that can be expanded depending on how deep people want to go. Or contracted, depending on what the nature of the conversation is. But I think there are lots of great assets and resources to build that. We just need to figure out how do we bring that together.
Sure.
I think the Council of Homeless would be a really good convener of that data. They already have a really good starting point with their new website that we saw in January.
Yeah, their new dashboard.
Yeah.
I love it.
Well, Kate did a beautiful job presenting to the Vancouver Housing
Because you get real time.
I think that's
right there.
Yeah, they're doing great work. Yeah, thank you, Linda. That's really good.
we do have the task force for a CAB, as long as I've been, and I haven't been able to go for a while, but one of the things that I have noticed about it is there is no real direction there. It's talked about a lot, but there is no formulation of here's some goals, here's objectives, this is what we want to work on, this is how we can do it.
Kind of the advocacy task force?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that, okay. I was confused earlier because you said legislative advocacy.
Yeah, I was confused.
It is just
too.
Advocacy
just
in
advocacy.
General.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have been, I went to the last two meetings and we have been talking about, like, what do we even want to advocate for? Because there are some differences in, like, some of the things that some would like to advocate for are a little bit different than what the county prioritizes. So how do
yes.
we,
yeah.
you know.
And you can't, and that task force is made so, like, you can't represent the county because
yeah.
that's already represented. So it is looking at, is there legislative priorities that you can advocate for, but there has never really been a thing to actually work on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I know it's limited to how many people are active on this board is how many can actually attend the
See,
task force.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's maybe five. Right
yeah,
now.
It's been, yeah, me, you,
well, there's 13 with six,
Bridget,
right?
Me, you, Bridget, Adam, and Beth has been there.
Mm-hmm. I think the other challenge is no one, I think, feels like, well, first of all, everybody's working at top capacity. Nobody can imagine, no organization can imagine taking on this
mm-hmm.
kind of a
mm-hmm.
endeavor because everybody's, there's no money and there's everybody's overworked. So that makes it difficult. I also think that it's pretty hard for sweat groups and can presume that they're going to be the leader. As soon as they presume they are, somebody else says, well, what are they doing? They're doing it over here. So
yeah.
who is it? How high up do we have to get? Do we can get some kind of organizational
We do have the continuum
group.
Of care, which is supposed to help lead us in the direction that we shall be encompassing.
I think that really represents, though, just the continuum of care, not a lot of those community assets that
they're
Mark was
that.
Talking about. Yeah. And just the COC, that's a tall order.
Mm-hmm.
Organizing
yeah.
that whole system.
They get close to it with the community health workers,
mm-hmm.
but that's a key
yeah.
point. All these institutions are constrained.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know, SWATCH
yeah.
is trying to do some coordinating
mm-hmm.
with community health workers, and it's a very large... It's very large.
Well, that disappears in 2 years.
Uh-huh.
But the problem is here, we all know it. And everybody recognizes what has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so everybody knows we need coordination. We need a continuum of care that really oversees all of it, not just housing people.
Yeah.
But so when do we make the step? Who makes the step to say, okay, we recognize it, we know it's a problem, now we just have to start being organized. And I think, like Mark said, the solutions are all around us. I think it's just a matter of organizing us so we know where the gaps are and where the duplications are. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know who is that group that starts that discussion and just says, or a group that comes together as some kind of a
mm-hmm.
tribunal, I don't know what you would call it, and it says, you know, we're taking in all the input and trying to help that dashboard get coordinated. Because, yes, when you get that dashboard down, it's so complicated and so complex. It's like, oh, I don't know where to start.
Well, I almost wonder if the starting point is just explicitly defining what the goal is. What are we hoping to accomplish by this process or this new group or this new
mm-hmm.
innovation? I mean, we just need to know, like, what are we trying to accomplish? And then you need to send it out and see if anyone's already working on it. And if it truly is a gap, then find stakeholders that are really interested in putting the groundwork in place and the infrastructure in place to achieve that goal. But even for me, like even hearing our discussion, like I'm not necessarily like explicitly clear on like what does success look like in this new process or connecting our community assets with our current continuum of care system. And because you've got mental health who's doing a ton of work, you've got the healthcare system doing a ton of work, you've got the social services doing a ton of work, you've got the schools doing a ton of work. So you have all of these siloed institutional government entities that are putting a lot of effort, time, and talent into a solution. And I know there are like more governing groups that are meeting together and collaborating and innovating and discussing what they're doing, but I don't know if that information is being disseminated to those of us on the ground that are the advocates that are in the trenches, that are the individuals who are impacted by this crisis. So I think we just need to know if this group as a CAB board wants to say, here's a goal, and then have the county and others see if it's being addressed, and if not, then maybe it is an advocacy task force thing.
Two comments I would have. Number one, I think this is the most legitimate entity when you look at the history of nonprofit mobilization. Community Action Agency is a key driver on that. So you have legitimacy from that standpoint to say, hey, we've been playing this game for 50-some years. It's time for us to step back and look at what the world looks like today. Secondly, for you to go out with a survey of types with your declaration of what you believe to be so, because who has more right than you to declare what is so and what do you want to be so, and then to seek out feedback. You're going to, depending on how you structure that survey, you're going to glean exceptional information about what's really present and who's invested, mm-hmm. especially if you ask them to articulate how is your investment contributing to this targeted outcome.
So would you all be comfortable with asking Janet and Rebecca to make an agenda item for our next meeting to specifically discuss kind of what the hope is of this group?
Is that Ed Michael?
And Ed Michael, yeah, because I think they know this system. I mean, I know they know it way better than me. Like, I'm not in this world every day. But I do think as a board, it's important for us to at least explore if there are ways that we can help. Good?
Yes, that's for sure.
Okay. So I think caught that in the notes as an item. Okay. Any business for the good of the order from the group? I think this is a really good discussion. Any business?
I have what it's not really the housing, but it is. I am working with the Cowlitz Tribe on census, and I'm trying to do as much outreach as possible. So, if any of you work with Native families or individuals, please contact me because I want to make sure that they're counted in our census because Native populations are historically, ever since the census was created, always undercounted, and that impacts us in really big ways as far as like. Funding for healthcare to housing to mental health and everything in between. So if you know anybody, I would love, I will have tablets to help people fill it out. We're doing it online for the first time this year. So that's big changes. So
please. Thank you for your work on the census.
They are still hiring for the census too. Mm-hmm. And if you know people that are bi or trilingual, would be a good idea to let them know there's an opportunity. You get paid $20 per hour, and they said the hours are flexible. And I talked to, I think her name's Tanisha, who is hiring people recently. I was telling some deaf people in Washington State specifically that have applied and they would like the job. But some people are concerned about losing their SSDI, and she told me, and I said, please show me some facts so that I can show this as fact. But she told me that they would not lose it if they had this job. So, yeah, and so that's one of the concerns a lot of low income people are, and that could help some people prevent them from getting homeless to have this job and they have on the resume.
Absolutely.
You are not required to have a resume or references or cover letter or any past job experience to get hired.
They do a background check. But that's
it.
Okay.
It's a background check.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, our next meeting is Monday, I guess, May 5th. At 8 a.m., right?